We enter the sacred week, month of April, with Holy Week, with Passover, with Ramadan coming up, and what spirituality means at a time like this. We've been speaking with Bishop Clifton Daniel, Dean of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced by a remarkable group of people. Most are working from home to protect against community spread. Incredibly dedicated. I am in awe of my colleagues every day. Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Trina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriano Contreras, Maria Tara Sain. A special thanks to Julie Crosby and Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, confirmed cases and deaths due to COVID-19 continue to rise in Oregon and across the globe. States are donating ventilators to New York, the current epicenter of the U.S. coronavirus crisis, and some experts are warning that keeping 6 feet distance in public is not enough. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 6th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. As of Monday afternoon, there are 1,132 confirmed cases of coronavirus in Oregon. There have also been 29 deaths. Officials with the Oregon Health Authority announced 2 more deaths on Monday, a 93-year-old man in Washington County and a 70-year-old woman in Marion County. Both had underlying medical conditions. Washington State has reported 87,911 cases and 338 deaths. Nationally, the U.S. death toll surpassed 10,000 today, and at least 357,000 people across every state plus Washington, D.C., and 4 U.S. territories have tested positive. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are now recommending that people wear face masks in public, whether or not they have symptoms of COVID-19. Globally, the virus has sickened more than 1.2 million people across 176 countries. At least 72,000 people have died. United Kingdom Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been moved to an intensive care unit in the hospital after his virus symptoms worsened. The 55-year-old leader was admitted to the hospital on Sunday evening. Some experts are saying that the 6 feet distancing rule is not enough to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Richard Corsi, Dean of Portland State University's Massey College of Engineering and Computer Science, has studied the spread of the novel coronavirus. He recommends people stay 20 feet away from each other when they are outside. Indoors, where ventilation is much worse, Corsi recommends using extreme caution and only carrying out essential tasks like grocery shopping when it's truly necessary. Corsi's warning is supported by a study published last week in the Journal of American Medicine. Researchers found that the virus can travel as far as 27 feet indoors and remain floating in the air for hours. Scientists warn that the virus does not just spread through coughing and sneezing, rather it can enter the air when someone talks or even breathes. This week, the CDC said as many as 25% of people infected are asymptomatic, meaning they do not show any symptoms and may spread it unknowingly in the community. Kimberly Prather, chair of atmospheric chemistry at the University of California, San Diego, has warned that runners who exercise next to one another or bicyclists who ride one behind the other on roads also risk spreading the virus. Even though the outdoors has more airflow, microscopic particles remain floating in the air and can still infect others, especially on a calm evening with no wind. Both Oregon and Washington State have announced plans to send a shipment of ventilators to New York, the United States pandemic epicenter. New York State's death toll from COVID-19 has surpassed 4,000, and there are over 122,000 confirmed cases of the virus. More than 4,000 patients remain in intensive care, most needing ventilators. The state entered the crisis with around 3,500 machines. Governor Andrew Cuomo had warned the state could run out of ventilators sometime this week. Cuomo added that Oregon's donation was unsolicited and said that the decision was kind and smart, since the state is not expected to have a significant problem until May, while New York is already facing a shortage. Washington State has said they will return more than 400 ventilators it received from the Strategic National Stockpile so that they can be used in New York and other states that have been hit hardest by the coronavirus. Although Washington was one of the first places affected by the pandemic in the U.S., Governor Jay Inslee's statewide stay-home order and weeks of social distancing have led to slower growth in the number of cases and deaths. California also announced that it would loan 500 ventilators to the national stockpile for use by New York and other states. Statistics are showing a disturbing rise in domestic violence in Portland and the surrounding metro area since Governor Kate Brown's stay-home order has been put in effect. With families working from home or laid off, kids out of school with limited social activities allowed, and many outdoor distractions closed, the ongoing anxieties of life amid COVID-19 appear to be escalating the grim dynamics of toxic relationships. According to police precincts, complaints and arrests involving domestic abuse are considerably higher than at the same time last year. Portland Police says it has a 27% increase in arrests for domestic violence since the governor's stay-at-home order, with neighboring cities and counties reporting the same or higher. Raphael House of Portland, along with other domestic violence shelters, say they are working around the clock to help victims and survivors cope with the stay-at-home order, with the numbers of calls expected to increase. The National Domestic Violence Hotline says an abuser may take advantage of any stressful situation as leverage for more control, especially as a health crisis with great economic repercussions is happening. A guide to staying safe during COVID-19 is available online through the hotline and helps address issues specific to this unprecedented time. If you are experiencing domestic violence or abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233. Or, if you can't call safely, you can text LOVE to 22522 or log on to thehotline.org. Anyone who is in immediate danger is recommended to call 911. It is unclear if Oregon students will be able to return to the classroom this academic year. Some teachers are using innovative methods to check on their students' well-being. Eric Tigadoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
With schools closed, Oregon teachers are finding other ways to support students and their communities. Claudia McClellan is a Spanish teacher at Westview High School in the Beaverton School District. After classes were suspended, McClellan grew concerned about her students' well-being. She decided to connect everyone online and says what was supposed to be a 3-minute Zoom meeting lasted more than an hour.
they don't want to leave the chat. You know, they're like, but we have more questions. In reality, they want to talk with me, and they want to see their friends, and they want to laugh. I think we forgot for a little bit what was going on around us because we connect to each other.
The Oregon Department of Education says there's a chance students won't return to classrooms this academic year. In Oregon City, Ogden Middle School social studies teacher Megan Christopher is making sure kids are fed. Many students rely on school meals, so the district has set up food pickup locations around the area, offering lunch and breakfast for the next day. Christopher says about 50 to 60 families were helped during spring break, and the need has exploded since then. She says people in public education are doing a lot behind the scenes for families.
It's not just the kids that we teach, but it's also their parents and their grandparents and their siblings, that we really are connected with their families and the community. And sometimes people forget that teachers are really on the front lines in that way.
Stacy Barber, a biology teacher at David Douglas High School in Portland, says she heard about the need for fabric masks and decided to team up with her mom to meet the call.
So I came over and we looked up some fabric patterns, and we tried a couple, and she actually showed me how to use a sewing machine. I've never sewn before in my whole life, and we started getting going.
Barber says she and her mom have made more than 600 masks, providing them for free to caregivers, nurses, nursing home workers, and anyone else who needs them. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Support is available for Washington State families who are financially swamped because of the COVID-19 crisis. We go again to Eric Tegedoff with the Public News Service for the story.
The pandemic is taking a financial toll on Washington State families, but there are options to help them get through this crisis. Already, Washington is seeing record numbers of unemployment claims. More than 300,000 first-time claims applied for over the past 2 weeks. Marilyn Watkins with the Economic Opportunity Institute says Congress's stimulus package will add an extra $600 per week to unemployment checks through the end of July.
Really, anyone who's out of work or can't find work due to this virus and this pandemic outbreak will be able to get unemployment insurance. And that will be available to them retroactive to the end of March.
But Watkins notes that people who newly qualify should wait until at least April 18th to file, which is the state's goal for setting up its unemployment system for these applications. For essential workers still on the job, the federal stimulus package created more sick leave options. Workers can take 2 weeks off at full pay to care for themselves, and at two-thirds pay to care for a loved one, in addition to any other sick leave they might have. Parents can also get two-thirds pay for 10 weeks to care for children out of school or child care. The federal government will reimburse employers for this sick leave. Watkins says small businesses have options, including loans and grants from state and federal governments.
There's support for businesses who are able to maintain their workers, and there's going to be cash assistance and cash grants to small businesses to help them maintain people on payroll and maintain people with health insurance so that they can just immediately kick back into gear.
Washington State has a moratorium on evictions in place, and utility companies have pledged not to shut off people's power or water. And a stimulus check of up to $1,200 could be coming to people who make less than $100,000 as soon as this week. Watkins adds that this is just a start on the road to recovery, and Congress already is talking about another aid package. She says this crisis could create an opportunity to rebuild a better system.
We already had a lot of people barely making it and barely squeaking by paycheck to paycheck. So I think going forward, we really want to look at how can we come out of this even better and stronger and more resilient.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
One of Portland's most prominent patrons of the arts passed away Saturday. Arlene Schnitzer was 91 years old when she died of natural causes at home. With her name adorned on museums, hospitals, universities, temples, scholarships, award, and endowed positions, not to mention Portland's premier concert hall, Schnitzer was widely regarded as one of Portland's leading ladies of philanthropy. Arlene was born in Salem and moved to Portland with her family when she was 2 years old. She married husband Harold Schnitzer in 1949. After taking classes at the Museum Art School, she developed a relationship with the museum and other artists, believing deeply in the transformative power of art in a community. In 1961, Schnitzer founded and directed the Fountain Gallery of Art, helping spur a nationwide interest in Pacific Northwest art and culture. From 1968 to 1980, she produced public service television programming and hosted her own broadcast, focusing on controversial social issues rarely spoken of at the time. Over her lifetime, Arlene gave away more than $150 million to thousands of civic projects in Portland. Schnitzer also contributed to many other aspects of the community, serving on boards for Oregon Health and Science University, the Boys and Girls Club of Portland, McCallum Theater, and the Oregon Symphony, whose famed concert hall was named after her. She was also awarded the First Citizens Award and the Governor's Award for the Arts, among countless other achievements. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for three in-depth interviews examining the coronavirus crisis from an intergenerational and rural perspective. At 6, it's Labor Radio, then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 40 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy with a high of 60. Today in history, in 1896, the first modern Olympic Games are held in Athens, 1,500 years after being banned by Roman Emperor Theodosius. 13 nations participated in the first modern competition. The 2020 Olympic Games have been postponed for the first time in history. More than 200 countries had been planning to participate. The quote of the day is from Nelson Mandela, who said, quote, "Sport can create hope where there once was only despair. It is more powerful than governments in breaking down racial barriers. It laughs in the face of all types of discrimination." Navy captain who was removed from command of the USS Theodore Roosevelt has tested positive for COVID-19. Captain Brett Crozier was fired after a leak to the San Francisco Chronicle of a letter he had emailed to Navy leaders about the spread of the novel coronavirus on the aircraft carrier. The email detailed the Navy's failures to provide adequate resources to quickly move sick sailors off the carrier and disinfect areas on board as the virus spread through the ship. Crozier sent the letter on an unclassified email system to about 20 to 30 people. The acting Secretary of the Navy, Thomas Maudley, said he had lost confidence in Crozier's ability to command the ship effectively. According to Maudley, sending the email caused unnecessary alarm about the operational readiness of the ship and also undermined the chain of command. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper confirmed that there are 155 positive cases of COVID-19 among sailors on the ship, and more than half of all sailors aboard have been tested. So far, there have been no hospitalizations. On Friday, videos circulated showing hundreds of sailors aboard the aircraft carrier cheering for Crozier as he disembarked the ship. A Navy spokesman declined to comment on Crozier's status. A Louisiana pastor is under fire after defying COVID-19 social distancing orders as hundreds of churchgoers attended services for Palm Sunday over the weekend. Pastor Tony Spell welcomed throngs of worshipers to Life Tabernacle Church, located outside of Baton Rouge, despite an executive order issued from Louisiana Governor John Edwards banning public gatherings of 50 or more. Spell is maintaining that current public health orders are an increasing threat to religious freedoms and people's constitutional rights, adding that the pandemic response is, quote, politically motivated. Despite large services being held, police abstained from entering the church or disturbing the gatherings within. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers issued an executive order today delaying the state's primary election until June 9th because of health concerns over the ongoing coronavirus crisis. The order was issued early Monday afternoon, suspending all in-person voting on Tuesday, following ignored requests to the Republican-controlled legislature to extend absentee voting. A special session was ordered by Evers for a meeting with the legislature on Tuesday to consider a new date. If a decision is not reached, in-person voting will take place on June 9th. All ballots already cast will be counted. In an effort to challenge Evers' authority, a legal battle with Republicans motioning to restrain the governor's order with the Wisconsin Supreme Court is expected. Wisconsin elections are already under scrutiny as a national test case over voter access during the COVID-19 pandemic, with potential repercussions facing other presidential primaries as well as the November general election. The Democratic governor has also issued a stay-at-home order and closed all non-essential businesses amidst the ongoing pandemic. By now, we've all gotten used to President Trump ignoring the advice of scientists and healthcare experts during his daily coronavirus briefings. On Saturday, he directly refuted the recommendations of the Surgeon General. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has this commentary.
On Saturday, Surgeon General Jerome Adams changed course and announced that the CDC was recommending that everyone wear a mask in public.
We now know from recent studies that a significant portion of individuals with coronavirus lack symptoms. They're what we call asymptomatic. And that even those who eventually become pre-symptomatic can transmit the virus to others before they show symptoms. In light of this new evidence, CDC recommends and the task force recommends wearing cloth face coverings in public settings where other social distancing measures are difficult to maintain.
Dr. Adams stressed that masks didn't replace the need for social distancing, but that they were an especially good idea in close quarters, such as when you're in the grocery store or pharmacy. And as he was concluding his comments, he reminded people that this was a voluntary recommendation and gave this very compelling reason for why we should all wear masks in public.
Remember, this is all about me protecting you and you protecting me. This is about us coming together as communities, and if people voluntarily choose to wear a face covering, they're wearing it to protect their neighbors from getting the coronavirus.
To no one's great surprise, President Trump then stepped up to the microphone and immediately undermined Dr. Adams' efforts.
I don't think I'm going to be doing it. I'm feeling good. I just don't want to be doing, I don't know, somehow sitting in the Oval Office behind that beautiful, resolute desk. I think wearing a face mask as I greet presidents, prime ministers, dictators, kings, queens, I don't know, somehow I don't see it for myself. I just don't.
For the moment, let's ignore the fact that he just bragged about welcoming dictators into the Oval Office and zero in on his personal refusal to wear a mask. A majority of Americans disapprove of his handling of the coronavirus crisis, and we know better than to put any stock in what he says. And we know that he doesn't care about us. But there is a very substantial minority of Americans who are still ardent supporters that follow his lead. Doesn't he care about them? The President of the United States just heard the Surgeon General of the United States recommend that we wear face masks for the benefit of each other, and he shot him down in one sentence. Trump's performance during his daily coronavirus briefings have clearly demonstrated his narcissism, ignorance, and total lack of human empathy to the entire world. Since the first coronavirus case was confirmed in the U.S. on January 21st of this year, Trump has ignored the healthcare professionals and misled the public every step of the way. His lack of leadership will undoubtedly contribute to thousands of additional and needless American deaths. His behavior has been nothing short of criminal. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
A local air service in Alaska has ended operations due to COVID-19. The Pine Ridge Reservation is restricting non-residents, and the number of Navajo-positive coronavirus cases is now more than 350. With those stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Alaska, Raven Air suddenly ended service due to COVID-19, leaving rural communities without passengers or mail service and workers without jobs. Other regional airlines are stepping in to close the gaps. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports three airlines are expanding their routes in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and some are hiring.
Raven's announcement sent the Alaska aviation industry into a flurry. Grant Aviation General Manager Dan Kniezek says he spent the day in back-to-back conference calls with the U.S. Postal Service, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, and other airlines. Grant is adding passenger service to communities left with no way to fly after Raven dropped them, including St. Mary's and Mountain Village on the Lower Yukon River. Raven is still serving St. Mary's from Anchorage, but Grant will now connect St. Mary's to Bethel. Grant is also replacing Raven's route to the Nunavik Island community of McCoryuk. Grant is limited by the size of its fleet, but working to add new aircraft. With Grant expanding, it's hoping to hire pilots and rampers Raven laid off. Ute Commuter Service is another regional airline serving the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. It's also taking on mail and freight from Raven and adding passenger air service to a community Raven dropped. Ute station manager Andrew Flagg says that Ute will begin serving the community of Marshall on the Lower Yukon River once all the required paperwork is signed. On the Upper Kuskokwim River, Raven's departure left the community of Stony River without mail or freight delivery, severing it from vital access to medicine, food, and supplies. Ryanair President Lee Ryan says his company will begin providing the service on Monday and deliver three times per week. Ryanair is also absorbing portions of Raven's freight and mail throughout the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region. Ryan says his company has job openings and asks people to apply online. In late March, Ryanair gave frontline workers an 8% pay increase. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The Oglala Sioux Tribe in South Dakota has set up checkpoints to limit non-essential visitors and enact a shelter-in-place order in response to COVID-19. Michael Moen has more.
Tyler Yellowboy, the tribe's ambulance director and pandemic task force member, says they have no reported cases yet of COVID-19 and hope to keep it that way. But he says the pandemic could have a devastating impact if things change.
Our population is probably the most vulnerable, you know, due to our underlying health conditions such as diabetes and heart-related issues.
And Yellowboy says many of their members are elderly, creating more health risks. He adds they only have a handful of ventilators and beds at their main hospital. The tribe has made requests through the state for additional supplies. And Yellowboy says they're getting safety messages out on local radio and social media.
That was Michael Moen reporting. The number of positive cases of COVID-19 on the Navajo Nation has reached 354 as of Sunday. There are also 14 confirmed deaths related to the coronavirus. Navajo leaders and health officials are urging residents to stay home and follow emergency orders, including a nightly curfew. Navajo police have started to issue citations and fines for people found to be violating orders. The tribe is holding virtual town halls, radio announcements, and has billboards to provide updates on COVID-19. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 6th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Ray Bodwell, Melissa Hood, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11 on Stage and Studio, host Dime Roberts presents Alaska, the final episode of Indigify's special documentary series, Definition of Resilience, featuring musicians AK Rebel and Aku Matu discussing the effects of colonization. And at 11:30, Art Focus features interviews with artists, curators, and critics about art, how it's made, and what it means. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you would like to become a member, go to kboo.fm, or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth. Thank you.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Hi, I'm Suzanne LeGrand, and today I'm speaking with Apricot Irving, who is a writer, journalist, and teacher, about her experiences living through the pandemic. To start, I'm wondering if you could talk about what your life was like before the pandemic began. It was just an average day.
Well, it's funny. I was just about to head into a busy couple months of writing classes and flying to New York to teach a workshop and readings, and I had spent a lot of weeks and months leading up to it getting all those organized, and then it was kind of amazing. Within 2 days, it had all disappeared. Everything fell, and we were in this new reality together of being suddenly very curtailed in our movements. And to be honest, I'm a writer first, and the being an author and having events is new. So it felt like something of a relief to suddenly be forced to get quiet again and to not have my days fill up with email and event scheduling, but just to be forced to sit still again. And I'm not writing as much as I would like to be yet. I think, like most of us, there's a lot to process. And I think that I'm processing it, and then I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm worried, and I wake up and the dreams are all my subconscious processing it in ways that I didn't realize I was worried and anxious. And but it's forced me back into quiet again.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things are you worried about?
Oh, I'm worried about friends who are suddenly unemployed or who own small businesses and are struggling. I'm worried about friends who are in their 70s, relatives, people with fragile health. I didn't know I had so many people that I loved that had compromised immune systems. I'm worried about how we will all collectively recover from this, and if this will be a moment to really take into consideration the well-being of the whole, or if it's going to be another event that concentrates power and wealth, and that we aren't thinking about everyone.
Certainly, part of this situation has made clear what some of the fractures and inequalities are in our society. Have you noticed any particular ones that stand out to you as like, oh, this is really clear that this is not working and hasn't been?
Well, the access to medical care. I mean, the fact that we're even having conversations about whether the tests for the virus should be free, or if individuals should have to pay for them, much less treatment for these trips to the hospital. I mean, it shouldn't be that we have to consider whether we're at risk of losing our home, for example, to be able to cover our medical bills. That should be not a question for anyone to have to struggle with.
Mm. You live in a fairly rural community. Could you talk about what issues or differences that might involve as opposed to somebody who lives in a more urban area being under quarantine?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the advantages is it feels very lucky to be able to still walk over empty country roads. That's a great gift. We live on a lot of property, and so there's room to run around. It's interesting, being such a small community, we tend to know who the first responders are. There's a small rural fire department, and it's manned by volunteers. And there was an emergency preparedness meeting before we all went into lockdown, and the fire chief made it very clear that there's a really small group of people that are able to respond to emergencies. And if any of those people get sick or are suddenly unable to help, our little community is really going to be in crisis. And so just warning people in advance why all of these precautions are so necessary. And we went grocery shopping before. We're on day 11 of isolation as a family, and we were coming to the end of all the fresh vegetables would run out, and so we were trying to order online and be as careful as we could to keep out of the mix of social gatherings. I'd stopped by the little market that's out in our community, and there was a sign posted out front about how, please, if you're not from this area, that we have many at-risk people living out here, please consider taking your business elsewhere. And that was even when I had called ahead and they had the box waiting for me and were sterilizing the pens with bleach in between each signature for the credit card transactions. Mm-hmm. I think we feel it. Mm-hmm. Same as everyone, I suppose.
Yeah. How is it that you have found to deal with fear and uncertainty, which is, I think, something that everybody is struggling with?
Well, I have been using a trick that my therapist taught me a few years ago, which has been so valuable. And it was about how setting aside time every day to panic and freak out can be really valuable, but try to give it an apportioned time of your day and no more. So that when I wake up at 3 a.m. and I'm finding myself worrying, I can say, oh, right, I'm going to have my panic and freak out time at noon to 12:30. And we do it as a family. I have a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old and my partner, my husband. And so we'll try really hard to save all of our collective worrying together for the middle of the day. And we'll talk about what we've read on the news and what we've heard and the latest stuff, and we'll kind of worry together and then say, okay, right, ready to move on now. Because it can be really wearing to live in that space of anxiety constantly. So I'm trying to give it room, but also not let it take over.
Mm-hmm.
So when I sat down with the kids the very first day, when it just felt like everything was spinning so quickly, and they were really reeling. One of them was supposed to get together with a friend from out of state that's only here like twice a year, and school had just let out the day before. And so part of me thought, well, he's seen all his friends from school already. If they've had it, they've shared it. But then there was this other friend from out of state, and I couldn't do it. I said, sweetheart, I'm afraid we're not going to be able to see him. We have to be able to protect his grandmother. And he was really sad and really frustrated, but then he got it. So when we did our panic and freak out together collectively on that day, it's like, all right, let's talk about what we're afraid of. Let's talk about where we are feeling the loss today. And then let's talk about what we feel really grateful for, and talk about maybe what we might hope to be able to do in this, at the time, 14 days that we knew we were going to be isolating. And now, you know, it's a much longer stretch. But that's one thing we do. It's funny, I went on a walk with my 14-year-old one of the days, and I had been a little bit testy that morning. We'd all been squabbling. We're all on top of each other. We only see each other besides phone calls, which is good. But I was saying something about how, you know, I work really hard to keep my emotions in equilibrium. I have lots of strategies that I use. I was like, but you know what it would be like if I wasn't working this hard. And he's like, I know, Mom. Oh, we're going to know all each other's secrets by the end of this.
Have you been surprised by anything that has happened?
Oh, I've loved the images of people lighting candles and singing together and this collective gratitude for the people that are out there doing these essential jobs, bringing us food, keeping that food supply going in hospitals, the first responders. It's kind of, I miss that being out in the rural context. I don't have a sense of sharing with my neighbors and in our gratitude together for that. We have to come up with other creative ways of gathering, but I've loved that and been surprised by it. And I think too, and you mentioned this perhaps already in your opening, this is something that for the first time feels global. I mean, I suppose climate change is also a global crisis, but it didn't always feel like everyone was aware of it and sharing the worry over it, whereas this one feels a lot closer to being a shared global urgent concern. We're all impacted by it, and we all will be impacted by it in ways that we can't anticipate yet. It's still, the wave is still coming. We haven't yet seen what the impact will be. And I think, you know, I grew up in Haiti as a kid, locked up on a missionary compound plenty of times when there would be political disturbances and all the roads were shut, or there would be an environmental crisis and we'd be stuck in one place, the floods or hurricanes, or there would be an epidemic. And so in many ways, this feels very familiar. There's plenty of places around the world that live with uncertainty on a daily basis. And so that doesn't feel like a surprise. It feels like a, oh, right, of course. This kind of uncertainty in my body when I'm like not really thinking about anything and it comes back to me during the day, that's something that's far more universally shared than sometimes as Americans we always remember. Sometimes I feel like we have this illusion that we can control our situation and make a plan and make it happen, and we get really bent sideways when things don't go according to plan. And this is a moment where we are all experiencing together that there are things beyond our control and we can't plan. And so what can we do? We can notice. We can try to stay curious. We can try, I'm trying as a mom to be a good enough mom, not trying to be perfect, trying to be honest and vulnerable with my kids and practice that with them. Trying to be a good enough writer, which is like 45 minutes a day at this point, but that's something. A good enough partner, a good enough friend, trying to reach out to somebody that I love a day and have a good phone call that feels like connection.
What would you hope would change as a result of having gone through this, both locally in your community and also globally?
The first thing that I hope for is that it would have a lasting impact on our need to create a more sustainable balance in terms of our usage of energy and resources and our care for this planet that is our home. And it's been astounding to realize how quickly we can act when we are forced to. I mean, to just see the drop in emissions globally, clear skies over China, the aerial images over Italy and China, and I'm sure now over the U.S. as well, just seeing the drop in light pollution and energy pollution, it's kind of astounding. That the fact that we have more fossil fuel than there is demand for it, and so we're worrying about places to store this, that feels like a really hopeful thing to me. And my husband has a job that causes him to fly across the country all the time, and sometimes for one-hour meetings, and it just has always felt absurd and wasteful and problematic. And now all of that's being done on conference calls. And I hope that coming out of this, there'll be a different kind of realization of what we need to do versus what we've just gotten used to doing, and really to step back and evaluate strategically what's best for our future. And it feels kind of incredible that this would have been the 50th anniversary, well, it still will be, of Earth Day in April. There won't be large gatherings to celebrate it, but this Earth is getting a rest from us and our exertion and our exploitation of it in a way that I certainly didn't ever anticipate, and that it would happen this quickly. It's quite astounding, and I do have hope about that. I have hope that maybe this forced rest of paying attention, I know for me, one of the things that keeps me hopeful in moments like this is just minding the smallest beautiful things, maybe just the crunch of homemade bread or walking out along the road and a little weed growing up through a crack in the sidewalk or the sound of a bird in spring. There's so many fewer planes flying overhead. I can hear the birds differently now. I went out today and I picked a little sprig of a pink flowering plum tree and this bright yellow lichen that had fallen off a branch of a walnut tree. I don't know why only walnut trees seem to have this bright yellow lichen on it, but at that kind of paying attention, I think is what keeps us, what keeps me hopeful.
I have been speaking today with Apricot Irving, who is a writer, journalist, and teacher. I am Suzanne LeGrand for We Are All In This Together for KBOO Community Radio News, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Today on We Are All In This Together, I talked to Sammy Call, who is a sophomore at David Douglas High School, and her grandfather, Sam Call, who is a political activist and classical music enthusiast.
So, Sammy, I'm just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what your life was like before this pandemic happened and what's changed.
I mean, I guess before this, I was obviously used to going to school every day, but I was used to seeing more people, I think, is the main change I think of. I mean, I can text my friends and whatever, but all of us are talking about how we're kind of getting touch-starved because we're just around our families. I have a little brother, and it's starting to get to the point that I don't know how we're going to last another month in the same house with each other.
What do you find hardest about not being able to have face-to-face communication with your friends?
I think it's harder for me to be able to know when people are being sarcastic or making jokes or what they're thinking about something over text. And even over call, it's easier than text, but it's harder than face-to-face where I can see what they look like as they're saying something. So it means I have to ask for clarification about that type of thing a lot more. I know there are some friends I talk to only ever over text, but that's because we don't go to the same school and we'd have to coordinate meeting up, so it's easier to text than try to set all of that up just to communicate. But most of us that go to the same school usually will end off a texting conversation with something like see you tomorrow, and in person I think we tend to sort of touch each other a lot more because we can communicate at a distance, but there's something about touching another person that's comforting, I guess.
Have you found any ways to cope with this situation that is really strange for everybody, I think?
My family's sort of set up a routine for us. Like, every morning now, my dad's having us do an exercise thing, so we have something that we know is going to happen every day, regardless. And on my own, I think I've started to look at the work we were assigned, like, before school shut down, so I can read over it and sort of know what I'm going to be getting back into when I start getting assignments.
Do you find that you miss actually being in school, or is it nice to have a break from school?
I think it's sort of nice having a break, and this week would technically be when my school spring break was anyway, but it is starting to get to the point where I'm getting a little bit twitchy about not being able to hear directly what an assignment's going to be, especially with classes like math where it's sort of important that we're there and learning all of it every day, but they can't really send us assignments over email so much.
What worries you most about this situation?
I think for me it would mainly be that I know I have no real control over this, and in some ways that helps because I don't feel like I have a responsibility to fix things like I might with something closer to home. But on the other hand, something that's so clearly out of my control could go in so many directions, and sometimes it feels like I wouldn't be able to affect anything.
When you are allowed to go out again, what's the first thing you want to do?
Probably the first thing I'm going to want to do is go back to school and get to see my friends in person. It's been like 2 weeks since I've seen them last, and I'm already texting them how I miss you. I swear I'm just going to hug you for like 5 minutes straight when I see you again.
She introduced me to Harry Potter. I'm the one who introduced her to American history.
I am speaking with Sam Call, who is a political activist and a classical music enthusiast. How has your life changed as a result of this pandemic situation that we're in?
Hunkering down hasn't been a huge problem. I haven't seen my grandkids in person in over a week, and it's who knows how long this is going to last. That's the big hardship. But I'm basically, and I do like mixing with friends from time to time, but I am very easily a solitary person who can hole up with my piano and my books and work on projects and do chores. I was just sitting right now, next to the piano. I was working on a fugue of Bach and a part of a sonata of Beethoven, looking at some sketches. But this morning it was mostly chores, some emails. When I'm done with this interview, I'll probably go get some fresh air and come back in and look over the emails again and work on my compositions. If one of my grandkids call, they do, especially I love it, one of my grandkids loves to call on the phone on a video where I can, Tony and I can read stories to him. That's always great. That'll, you know, change the pace.
We've seen a lot of changes in the last week or so. From a political point of view, what concerns or worries you the most?
Well, I'll put it this way. I've grown up in a period where we've changed. Our country's always had this dialogue about which should come first, the government and its stewardship over the public good, or private enterprise with the market forces basically dominating. And I don't have to get into any of the ideological debates about this. With market, it's basically you're in it to get profit, personal advancement, whatever the public good may be out of it. But there are certain things that we have recognized, usually in crises, that we depend on in common. That's your common good. And it's usually in the form of, well, what happens if you have a natural disaster? What happens if you have a pandemic? What happens if you have a crop failure? Things like that. You start seeing, now I see why we have social mechanisms, social organizations, and why you've got agencies like the federal government who can coordinate all this. So the dialogue that has taken place from out of my high school years shifted towards, well, you know, government is too big. We spend too much time trying to regulate things. What we need to do is loosen up, get the markets working. Well, what's the result of that? the example, I'll just pin it down. I can use many examples, but this business with the coronavirus brings it to life. I forgot the exact numbers, but back when I was a boy, the system of medical care system said prescribed 4.5 beds per 1,000 people, something like that. It was prescribed from a wartime mobilization. We came right out of World War II, and we said, that's what you need. If you're going to be prepared. You don't want to be caught off guard. Well, what happens under that kind of thinking, that kind of preparedness is, if you got 3 beds that are not being used, big deal. That's what we need. We have it, just like you have a peacetime army. You keep it in place. Now shift the market. If you start farming that out to private enterprise naturally looks
Sam calls
beds and says, well, what good are they? They're not making us any money. We either have to get people using them in some way, or we got to make space for something else. And so, well, you can see, not just from this pandemic, but the hurricanes. Hurricane Katrina is the big one that most people think about. We as a nation have ceased to really provide for our infrastructure, whether it's a production infrastructure or healthcare infrastructure or school infrastructure, and that's your immune system. And so what I'm looking at is, one more time, we got an emergency. This is a huge one. What are we going to do? Well, you kind of feel people and our leadership thinking in terms of, well, how do we get in this mess? How do we reorganize ourselves maybe to not only overcome this immediate emergency, but be prepared for others? Except I'm looking at that $6 trillion package, and I'm finding $4 to $4.5 trillion is going to salvage the financial system. And that would be fine if you could demonstrate to me that their investments are going into real production. But it's not. It's basically buyback options and shoring up a bankrupt financial system that needs to go into reorganization. So my concern is basically, why are we still stuck on watching the stock markets instead of going out and doing an inventory of not only who's being affected by the coronavirus and what kind of healthcare infrastructure do we have? How can we mobilize? But also what's happening with our farms and our manufacturing and our food supplies, things like that. I'd rather go there, and I'd rather put the whole Wall Street system either on hold, a bank holiday, or on our, better yet, a reorganization. Find out what it's really worth, and if you've got some real assets, put it to work. If not, declare bankruptcy.
What's the best possibility or scenario you could see for us moving forward?
The best would be, this is a tall order, but it's the way to go, and we've done it sometimes crisis. I call it the Franklin Roosevelt moment, not because of the man, but the administration, that whole approach to the Depression. What I hope is when it's all done, we say, wait a minute. Now, let's get back here. This things haven't worked before. So let's go back and reorganize the way we do business in terms of our public affairs and the role of government in it. I'm hoping we actually go back to a New Deal type of approach, to put it simply. You've got to organize the nation around projects and infrastructure that we are going to need in common to produce our food, to trade with each other, and sometimes to defend against, you know, an invasion or a national disaster.
This is Suzanne LeGrand for We Are All In This Together for KBOO Community Radio News, KBOO 90.7 FM.
Thank you. To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up.